Once through the glass doors, I walked down the marble steps and across the wide forecourt of the Gateway Monument to the sea. Beneath the arched shadow, I leant on the sea wall and looked out at the boats carrying tourists back to the marina. How many of those lives, I wondered, watching the travellers pose for one another's cameras. Are happy and carefree and simply free. How many of them are sorrowing? How many are... And then the full darkness of that long-resisted grieving closed around me. I realized that for some time I'd been gritting my teeth and that my jaw was cramped and stiff, but I couldn't unlock the muscles. I turned my head to see one of the street boys, someone I knew well, doing business with a young tourist. The boy, Mukul, sent his eyes left and right, lizard quick, and passed a small white packet to the tourist. The man was about 20 years old, tall and fit and handsome. I guessed him to be a German student, and I had a good eye. He hadn't been in the city long. I knew the signs. He was new blood, with money to burn, and the whole world of experience open to him. And there was a spring in his step as he walked away to join his friends. But there was poison in the packet in his hand. If it didn't kill him outright, in a hotel room somewhere, it would deepen in his life maybe, as it did once in mine, until it poisoned every breathing second. I didn't care. Not about him or me or anyone. I wanted it. I wanted the drug just then more than anything in the world. My skin remembered the satin flush of ecstasy and the lichen-stippled creep of fever and fear. The smell taste was so strong that I felt myself retching it. The hunger for oblivion, painless, guiltless, and unsorrowing, swirled in me, shivering from my spine to the thick, healthy veins in my arms. And I wanted it. The golden minute in heroin's long, leaden night. Mukul caught my eye and smiled from habit, but the smile twitched and crumbled into uncertainty. And then he knew. He had a good eye too. He lived on the street and he knew the look. So the smile returned, but it was different. There was seduction in it. It's right here. I've got it right here. It's good stuff. Come and get it. And the dealer's tiny, vicious little sneer of triumph. You're no better than me. You're not much at all. And sooner or later, you'll beg me for it. The day was dying. Each jeweled shimmer, dazzling from the waves in the bay, turned from glittering white to pink and weak blood-red. Sweat ran into my eyes as I stared back at Mukul. My jaws ached and my lips quivered with the strain of it, the strain of not responding, not speaking, not nodding my head. I heard a voice or remembered it. All you have to do is nod your head. That's all you have to do. And it'll all be over. And grieving tears boiled up in me, relentless as the gathering tide that slapped against the sea wall. But I couldn't cry them, those tears, and I felt that I was drowning in a sorrow that was bigger than the heart that tried to hold it. I pressed my hands down on the little mountain range of the faceted bluestones on the top of the sea wall, as if I could drive my fingers into the city and save myself by clinging to her. But Mukul smiled, promising peace. And I knew there were so many ways to find that peace. I could smoke it in a cigarette, or chase it on a piece of foil, or snort it, or puff it in a chillum, or spike it into my vein, or just eat it, just swallow it, and wait for the creeping numbness to smother every pain on the planet. And Mukul, reading the sweating agony, like a dirty page in a dirty book, inched his way closer to me, sliding along the wet stone wall. And he knew it. He knew everything. A hand touched my shoulder. Mukul flinched as if he'd been kicked, and backed away from me, his dead eyes dwindling to nothing in the burning splendour of the setting sun. And I turned my head to stare into the face of a ghost. It was Abdullah. My Abdullah. My dead friend, killed in a police ambush too many suffering months before. His long hair was cut short and thick like a movie star's. His black clothes were gone. He wore a white shirt and grey trousers with a fashionable cut. And they seemed strange, those different clothes. Almost as strange as seeing him standing there. But it was Abdullah Tahiri, his ghost, as handsome as Omar Sharif on his 30th birthday, as lethal as a big cat prowling, a black panther, and with those eyes the colour of sand in the palm of your hand a half hour before sunset. Abdullah.
It is so good to see you, Alin, brother. Shall we go inside and drink some chai?
That was it. Just that.
Well, I can't do that.
Why not? The ghost asked, frowning.
Well, for starters, I mumbled, shielding my eyes from the late afternoon sun with my hand as I stared up at him. Because you're dead.
I am not dead, Lin brother.
Yes.
No.
Did you speak to Salman?
Salman?
Yes. He arranged it for me to meet with you in the restaurant. It was a surprise.
Salman told me there was a surprise.
And I am the surprise, Lin brother, the ghost smiled. You were coming to meet me. He was supposed to be making it a surprise for you. But you left the restaurant. And the others, they have been waiting for you. But you didn't come back, so I went to find you. Now the surprise is really a shock.
Don't say that, I snapped, remembering something Prabhakar had once said to me, and still reeling, still confused.
Why not?
It doesn't matter. Fuck, Abdullah, this is a fucking weird dream, man.
I am back, he said calmly, a little frown of worry creasing his brow. I am here again. I was shot. The police, you know about it.
The tone of the conversation was matter of fact. The fading sky behind his head and the passers-by on the street were unremarkable. Nothing matched the blur and streak of a dream. Yet it had to be a dream. Then the ghost lifted his white shirt to reveal his many wounds, healed and healing into dark-skinned rings, whorls, and thumb-thick gashes.
Look, Lin brother, the dead man said. I was shot, yes, many times, but I did live. They took my body from the Crawford Market police station. They took me to Tana for the first 2 months. Then they took me to Delhi. I was in hospital for 1 year. It was a private hospital, not far from Delhi. It was a year of many operations. Not a good year, Lin brother. Then it was almost another year to become well, Nushkur Allah.
Abdullah, I said, reaching out to hug him. The body was strong, warm, alive. I held him tightly, clamping my hand to my wrist behind his back. I felt the press of his ear against my face and smelt the soap on his skin. I heard his voice passing from his chest to mine like ocean sonancies, sounding and resounding, wave on wave through shores of tight wet sand at night. Eyes closed and clinging to him, I floated on the dark water of the sorrowing I'd done for him, for both of us. Heart crippled with fear that I was mad, that it was really a dream, a nightmare, I held him until I felt the strong hands push me gently to the length of his extended arms.
It is okay, Lin, he smiled.
The smile was complex, shifting from affection to solace, and a little shocked, perhaps, at the emotion in my eyes.
It is okay.
It's not okay, I growled, breaking away from him. What the fuck happened? Where the fuck have you been? And why the fuck didn't you tell me?
No, I could not tell you.
Bullshit, of course you could. Don't be so stupid.
No, he insisted, running a hand through his hair and squinting his eyes to fix me with a determined stare. Do you remember one time we were riding the motorcycles and we saw some men? They were from Iran. I told you to wait at the motorcycles, but you did not. You followed me, and we fought those men together. Do you remember?
Yes.
They were enemies of mine. And they were Kadar Khan's enemies also. They had a connect to the Iran secret police. They knew Savak.
Can we... Wait a minute, I interrupted, reaching backward to support myself against the sea wall. I need a cigarette. I flipped open the box to offer him one.
Did you forget? He asked, grinning happily. I do not smoke the cigarettes. And you should not also, Lynn, brother. I only smoke the hashish. I have some, if you would like.
Fuck that, I laughed, lighting up. I'm not getting stoned with a ghost.
Those men, the men we fought, they did some business here. Mostly drugs business, but sometimes guns business and sometimes passports. And they were spies against us, reporting about any of us from Iran who ran away from the Iraq war. I was one man who ran away from the Iraq war. Many thousands ran away to here, India, and many thousands who hate Ayatollah Khomeini. The spies from Iran, they made reports about us to the new Savak in Iran. And they hate Kadar because he want to help the Mujahideen in Afghanistan and because he did help so many of us from Iran. You understand this business, Lynn, brother?
I understood it. The Iranian expatriate community in Bombay was huge, and I had many friends who'd lost their homeland and their families and were struggling to survive. Some of them worked in existing mafia gangs like Kadar's Council. Others had formed their own gangs, hiring themselves out to do the wet work, in a business that got a little bloodier every working day. I knew that the Iranian secret police had spies circulating among the exiles, reporting on them and sometimes getting their own hands a little damp.
Go on, I said, taking a gulp of smoky air from my cigarette. When those men, those spies, made their reports, our families in Iran had very bad suffering. Some mothers, brothers, fathers, they put them into the secret police prison. They torture people in that place. Some of the people, they died. My own sister, they torture and rape her because of the reports about me. My own uncle, he is killed when my family cannot pay to the secret police quick enough. When I find out about that, I told to Abdelkader Khan that I want to leave him so I can fight them. Those men who are spies from Iran. He told me not to leave. He said to me that we will fight them together. He told me that we will find them one by one. And he promised me that he will help me to kill them all.
Kadar Bhai, I said, breathing smoke.
And we found them, some of them, Farid and me, with Kadar's help. There was 9 men at the start. We found 6 men. Those men, we finished. The other 3 of them did live. 3 men. And they knew something about us. They knew that there is a spy in the council, very close to Kadar Khan.
Abdul Ghani.
Yes, he said, turning his head to spit at the mention of the traitor's name. Ghani, he came from Pakistan. He had many friends in the Pakistan secret police, the ISI. They work in secret with the Iran secret police, the new Savak, and with CIA, and with Mossad.
I nodded, listening to him, and thinking about something Abdul Ghani had said to me once. All the secret police in the world work together, Lynn, and that is their biggest secret.
So the Pakistan ISI told the Iranian secret police about their contact on the Kadar Council.
Abdul Ghani?
Yes, he replied.
In Iran, they were very worried. 6 good traitors gone. Nobody ever can find the bodies of those traitors. Only 3 were left. They're 3 men from Iran. So then they work with Abdul Ghani. He told them how to make a trap for me. At that time, do you remember? We did not know it, that Shapna, he was working for Ghani and planning to move against us. Kader did not know. I did not know. If I knew that, I would put the pieces of those Shapna men into Hassam Obikwa's hole in the ground myself. But I did not know. When I came into the trap, near to Crawford Market, the men from Iran fired the first time from a place near me. The police, they think that I am firing my gun. They fire at me. I am dying, I know. So I take my guns and I shoot at the police. The rest, you know.
Not all of it, I grunted. Not enough. I was there that night, the night you got shot. I was in the crowd at Crawford Market Police Station. It was wild. Everyone said you were shot so many times that your face was unrecognizable.
There was so much blood. But Kader's men, they did know me. They make a riot, and then they fight step by step into the police station, and they take my body out of there and away to the hospital. Kader had a truck near there, and he had a doctor. You know him, Dr. Hamid. Do you remember him? And they saved me.
Khaled was there that night. Was he the one who rescued you?
No. Khaled was one of the men who made the riot. It was Farid who took my body.
Farid the fixer got you out of there? I gasped, stunned that he'd said nothing about it in all the close months we'd worked together. And he's known about it all this time.
Yes. If you have a secret, Lin, put it in the heart of Farid. He is the best of them, my brother, now that Abdelkader is gone. After Nazir, Farid is the best of them. Never forget that.
What about the 3 guys, the 3 Iranian guys? What happened to them after you got shot? Did Kader get them?
No. When Abdelkader killed Shapna and his men, they ran away to Delhi.
One of the Shapna guys got away. You know that?
Yes, he went to Delhi also. When I was strong again, not completely fixed up yet, but strong enough to fight, just 2 months ago, I went to look for the 4 men and their friends. I found one of them, one from Iran. I finished him. Now there are only 3 left from that time, 2 spies from Iran and 1 Shapna killer from Ghani.
Do you know where they are?
Here, in the city.
You're sure?
I am sure. That is why I have come back to Bombay. But now, Lin brother, we must return to the hotel. Salman and the others, they are waiting for us upstairs. They want to make a party. They will be happy I can find you. They did see you leaving hours before with a beautiful girl, and they told me I will not find you.
It was Lisa, I said, glancing unconsciously over my shoulder at the bedroom window on the first floor of the Taj. Do you want to see her?
No, he smiled. I did meet someone. Farid's cousin, Amina. She has been looking after me for more than a year. She is a good girl. We want to be married.
Get the fuck out of here, I spluttered, more shocked by his intention to marry than I was by his survival of the killing fusillade.
Yes, he grinned, reaching out to give me an impulsive hug. But come on, the others are waiting. Chalo.
You go ahead, I answered him, smiling to match his happy grin. I'll be with you soon.
No, come, Lin, he urged. Come now.
I need a minute, I insisted. I'll be there in a minute. He hesitated a moment more, but then smiled, nodded his head, and walked back through the domed arch toward the Taj Hotel. Evening dimmed the afternoon's bright halo. A haze of dusty smoke and vapor misted the horizon, sizzling soundlessly, as if the sky at the distant wall of the world was dissolving into the waters of the bay. Most of the boats and ferries were safely tied to their mooring posts at the dock beneath me. Others rose and fell and rose again, swaying on the secure tethers of their sea anchors. High tide pushed the swollen waves against the long stone wall where I stood. Here and there along the boulevard, frothy plumes, like gasps of effort, slapped up, over, and onto the white footpaths. Strollers walked around the intermittent fountains, or ran laughing through the sudden boom and spray. In the little seas of my eyes, those tiny blue-grey oceans, waves of tears pushed hard against the wall of my will. "Did you send him?" I whispered to the dead Khan, my father. Assassin grief had pushed me to that wall, where the street boys sold heroin. And then, when it was almost too late, Abdullah had appeared. "Did you send him to save me?" The setting sun, that funeral fire in the sky, seared my eyes, and I looked away to follow the last flares of cerise and magenta streaming out and fading in the ocean-mirrored sapphire of the evening. And staring out across the rile and ruffle of the bay, I tried to fit my feelings within a frame of thought and fact. Strangely, weirdly, I'd re-found Abdullah and re-lost Kadarbai on the same day, in the same hour. And the experience of it, the fact of it, the inescapably fated imperative of it, helped me to understand. The sorrowing I'd shunned had taken so long to find me, because I couldn't let him go. In my heart, I still held him as tightly as I'd hugged Abdullah only minutes before. In my heart, I was still there on the mountain, kneeling in the snow and cradling the handsome head in my arms. As the stars slowly reappeared in the silent endlessness of sky, I cut the last mooring rope of grief and surrendered to the all-sustaining tide of destiny. I let him go. I said the words, the sacred words. "I forgive you." And it was good. And it was right. I let the tears fall. I let my heart break on my father's love, like the tall waves beside me that hurled their chests against the wall and bled onto the wide white path. Chapter 40. The word mafia comes from the Sicilian word for bragging. And if you ask any serious man who commits serious crimes for a living, he'll tell you it's just that, the boasting, the pride, that gets most of us in the end. But we never learn. Maybe it's not possible to break laws without boasting about it to someone. Maybe it's not possible to be an outlaw without being proud in some way. Certainly, in those last months of the old mafia, the brotherhood that Kadarbai had designed, steered and ruled, there was plenty of boasting and no less pride. But it was the last time that any of us, in that corner of Bombay's underworlds of crime, could have said with complete honesty that we were proud to be gangsters. Kadar Khan had been dead for almost 2 years, but his precepts and principles still dominated the day-to-day operations of the Mafia Council he'd founded. Kader had hated heroin, and he'd refused to deal in the drug or permit anyone else but desperately addicted street junkies to trade in it within the areas he'd controlled. Prostitution had also appalled him. He'd seen it as a business that injured women, degraded men, and blighted the community where it occurred. The hemisphere of his influence had extended to all the streets, parks, and buildings across several square kilometres. Within that little kingdom, any man or woman who hadn't kept their involvement with prostitution and pornography to very low, very discreet levels of activity had risked his condign punishment. And that situation prevailed under the new council, headed by Salman Mushtan. Old Shaban Mahmud, still the nominal head of the council, was gravely ill. In the years since Kader died, he'd suffered two strokes that had left his speech and much of his movement severely impaired. The council moved him into Kader's beach house in Versova, the same house where I'd gone through cold turkey with Nazir. They ensured that the aged Don had access to the best medical treatments and arranged for his family and his servants to attend him. Nazir slowly groomed Kader's nephew, young Tariq, for what most on the council assumed would be a leading role. Despite the boy's pedigree, his maturity, and his unusually solemn demeanor, there was no one, man or boy, whose dour, fervent intensity reminded me so much of Khalid. Tariq was deemed to be too young to claim a council position, or even to attend the council meetings. Instead, Nazir gave him duties and responsibilities that more gradually acquainted him with the world he might one day command. In all practical senses, Salman Mushtan was the Don, the new Khan, the leader of the council and the ruler of Kaderbai's mafia. And Salman, as everyone who knew him testified, was Kaderbai's man, body and soul. He governed the actions of the clan as if the grey-haired lord was still there, still alive, advising and cautioning him in private sessions every night. Most of the men supported Salman unquestioningly. They understood the principles involved and agreed that they were worth upholding. In our area of the city, the words gunda and gangster weren't an insult. Local people knew that our branch of the mafia did a better job than the police at keeping heroin and salacious crimes from their streets. The police, after all, were susceptible to bribes. Indeed, Salman's mafia clan found itself in the unique position of bribing the police. The same cops who'd just been paid off by pimps and pushers. To look away whenever they had to run a recalcitrant heroin dealer into a brick wall, or take a mash hammer to a pornographer's hands. Old men in the district nodded to one another and compared the relative calm on their streets with the chaos that tumbled and trawled through the streets of other districts. Children looked up to the young gangsters, sometimes adopting one as a local hero. Restaurants, bars, and other businesses welcomed Salman's men as preservers of peace and comparatively high moral standards. And the informing rate in the areas of his control, the amount of unsolicited information supplied to the police, a sure indicator of public popularity or displeasure, was lower than in any other area across the whole seething sprawl of Bombay. We had pride, and we had principle. And we were almost the men of honour that we believed ourselves to be. Still, there were a few grumbles of complaint within the clan, and some council meetings hosted fierce, unresolved arguments about the future of the group. The heroin trade was making other mafia councils rich. New smack millionaires flaunted their imported cars, designer clothes, and state-of-the-art electronic gadgets at the most exclusive and expensive venues in the city. More significantly, they used their inexhaustible opiate-based income streams to hire new men, mercenaries who were paid well to fight dirty and to fight hard. Little by little, those gangs expanded their territories in turf wars that left a few of the toughest men dead, many more wounded, and cops all over the city lighting incense sticks to give thanks for their luck. With similarly high profits derived from the new and insatiable market for imported hardcore pornographic videos, some of the rival councils had accumulated enough money to acquire that ultimate status symbol for any criminal gang, a hoard of guns. Envious of the wealth amassed by such gangs, infuriated by their territorial gains, and wary of their growing power, some of Salman Mushtan's men urged him to change his policy. First among those critical voices was that of Sanjay, Salman's oldest and closest friend. "You should meet with Chuha," Sanjay said earnestly, as he, Farid, Salman and I drank chai at a little shop on Maulana Azad Road near the brilliant green mirages of the Mahalakshmi racecourse. He was talking about Ashok Chandrasekhar, an influential strong-arm man in the Walid Lala gang. He'd used Ashok's nickname, Chuha, meaning the rat.
I've met with the fucker, yeah? Salman sighed. I meet him all the time. Every time one of his guys tries to squeeze out a corner of our territory, I meet with Chuha to set it straight. Every time our guys get in a fight with his guys and give them a solid pasting, I meet with Chuha. Every time he makes an offer to join our council to his, I meet with him. I know the fucker too well, that's the problem.
The Walid Lala Council held a contiguous border with our own. Relations between the gangs were generally respectful but not cordial. Walid, the leader of the rival council, had been a close friend of Qadir Bai, and with him was one of the original founders of the council system. Although Walid had led his council into the heroin and pornography trade that he, like Qadir Bai, had once despised, he'd also insisted that no conflict with Salman's council should occur. Chuha, his second in command, had ambitions that strained at the leash of Walid's control. Those ambitions led to disputes and even battles between the gangs, and all too often forced Salman to meet with the rat at stiffly formal dinners held on neutral ground in a suite at a five-star hotel.
No, but you haven't really talked to him, one-on-one-like, about the money we can make. If you did, Salman brother, I know you'd find out he talks a lot of sense. He's making crores out of the fucking Garad man. The junkies can't get enough of this shit. He has to bring it in by fucking train. And the Blue Movies thing, man, it's going crazy. I swear, it's a fucking deadly business, yeah? He's making 500 copies of every movie and selling them for 500 each. That's 2.5 lakhs, Salman, for every fucking Blue movie. If you could make money like that by killing people, India's population problem would be solved in a month. You should just talk to him, Salman brother.
I don't like him, Salman declared, and I don't trust him either. One of these days, I think I'll have to finish the Marachud once and for all. That's not a very promising way to start up a business, no?
If it comes to that, I'll kill the Gandu for you, brother, and it will be my pleasure. But up to then, like, before we actually have to kill him, we can still make a lot of money with him.
I don't think so.
Sanjay looked around the table for support and finally appealed to me.
Come on, Lin, what do you think?
It's council business, Sanjay, I replied, smiling at his earnestness. It's got nothing to do with me.
But that's why I'm asking you, Lin Baba. You can give us an independent point of view, like. You know Chuha, and you know how much money there is in the heroin. He's got some good money ideas, don't you think so?
Aray, don't ask him, Farid cut in. Not unless you want the truth.
No, go on,
Sanjay persisted, the gleam in his eyes brightening. He liked me, and he knew that I liked him.
Tell me the truth. What do you think of him?
I glanced around at Salman, and he nodded, just as Qadir might have done.
I think Chuha's the kind of guy who gives violent crime a bad name, I said.
Salman and Farid spluttered their tea, laughing, and then mopped at themselves with their handkerchiefs.
Okay,
Sanjay frowned, his eyes still gleaming.
So what exactly don't you like about him?
I glanced again at Salman. He grinned back at me, raising his eyebrows and the palms of his hands in a don't-look-at-me gesture.
Chuha's a standover man, I replied, and I don't like standover men.
He's a what?
A standover man, Sanjay. He beats up on men he knows can't fight back and takes whatever he wants from them. In my country, we call those guys standover men because they really do stand over little guys and steal from them.
Sanjay looked at Farid and Salman with a blank expression of confused innocence.
I don't see the problem, he said.
No, I know you don't have a problem with it, and that's okay. I don't expect everyone to think like me. Fact is, most people don't. And I understand that, I get it. I know that's how a lot of guys make their way. But just because I understand it, that doesn't mean I like it. I met some of them in jail. A couple of them tried to stand over me. I stabbed them. None of the others ever tried it again. The word got around. Try and stand over this guy and he'll put a hole in you. so they left me alone. And that's just the thing. I would have had more respect for them if they'd kept on trying to stand over me. I wouldn't have stopped fighting them. I still would have cut them up, you know, but I would have respected them more while I did it. Ask the waiter here, Santosh, what he thinks of Chuha. They came in here last week, Chuha and his guys, and slapped him around for 50 bucks. The word bucks was Bombay slang for rupees. 50 rupees was the same amount, I knew, that Sanjay customarily tipped waiters and better than average cab drivers. The guy's a fucking millionaire, if you believe his bullshit, I said. And he stands over a decent working guy like Santosh for 50 bucks. I don't respect that. And in your heart of hearts, Sanjay, I don't think you do either. I'm not going to do anything about it. That's not my job. Chuha makes his graft by slapping people. I understand that. But if he ever tries to stand over me, I'll cut him. And I tell you, man, I'll enjoy doing it. There was a little silence while Sanjay pursed his lips, twirled his hand palm upward, and looked from Salman to Fareed. Then all three of them burst out laughing.
You asked him, Fareed giggled. Okay, okay, Sanjay conceded. I asked the wrong guy. Lin is a wild guy, yeah. He gets wild notions. He went to Afghanistan with Carter, man. Why did I ask a guy who's crazy enough to do that? You run that clinic in the Jopad party and you never made a fucking paise out of it. Remind me of that, Lin, brother, if I ever ask you for your business opinion again, nah?
And another thing, I added, keeping a straight face.
Hey, Bhagwan, Sanjay cried. He's got another thing yet.
If you think about the slogans, you'll understand where I'm coming from on this.
The slogans?
Sanjay protested, provoking his friends to bigger laughter.
What fucking slogans, yeah?
You know what I mean. The slogan or the motto of the Walid Lala gang is Pahile Shahad Tab Jum. I think I'm right in translating it as first honey, then outrage, or even atrocity. Isn't that right? And isn't that what they say to each other as their slogan?
Yeah, yeah, that's their thing, man.
And what's our slogan? Kader's slogan. They looked at one another and smiled. Sach or Himat. I spoke it aloud for them. Truth and courage. I know a lot of guys who like Chuha's slogan. They think it was clever and funny, and it sounds ruthless, so they'd think it was tough. But I don't like it. I like Kader's. At the sound of an Enfield engine, I looked up to see Abdullah park his bike outside the chai shop and wave to me. It was time for me to go. I'd spoken the truth as I saw it, and I meant every word. But in my own heart of hearts, I knew that Sanjay's argument, although not better, would turn out to be stronger than mine. The Walid Lala gang under Chuha was the future of all the mafia councils, in a sense, and we all knew it. Walid was still the head of the council that bore his name, but he was old and he was ill. He'd ceded so much power to Chuha that it was the younger Don who ruled. Chuha was aggressive and successful, and he gained new ground by conquest or coercion every few months. Sooner or later, if Salman didn't agree to merge with Chuha, that expansion would come to open conflict, and there would be a war. I hoped, of course, that Kader's council under Salman would win. But I knew that if we did win, it would be impossible to claim Chuha's territory without also absorbing his trade in heroin, women, and porn. It was the future, and it was inevitable. There was simply too much money in it. And money, if the pile gets high enough, is something like a big political party. It does as much harm as it does good. It puts too much power in too few hands, and the closer you come to it, the dirtier you get. In the long run, Salman could walk away from the fight with Chuha, or he could defeat him and become him. Fate always gives you two choices, Scorpio George once said. The one you should take, and the one you do. But hey, I said, standing to leave, it's got nothing to do with me. And frankly, I don't really give a damn one way or the other. My ride is here. I'll see you guys later. I walked out, with Sanjay's protests and his friend's laughter rattling above the clatter of cups and glasses.
Bahinchud! Gandu! Sanjay shouted. You can't fuck up my rave like that and then walk out, yeah? Come back here!
As I approached him, Abdullah kick-started the bike and straightened it from the side stand, ready to ride. You're in a hurry for your workout, I said, settling myself onto the saddle of the bike behind him. Relax. No matter how fast we get there, I'm still going to beat you, brother. For 9 months, we trained together at a small, dark, sweaty, and very serious gym near the Elephant Gate section of Ballard Pier. It was a Gunda's gym set up by Hussein, the one-armed survivor of Kader's battle with the Shapna assassins. There were weights and benches, a judo mat, and a boxing ring. The smell of man sweat, both fresh and fouled into the stitching of leather gloves and belts and turnbuckles, was so eye-wateringly rancid that the gym was the only building in the city block that rats and cockroaches spurned. There were bloodstains on the walls and the wooden floor, and the young gangsters who trained there accumulated more wounds and injuries in a workout week than the emergency ward of a city hospital on a hot Saturday night.
Not today, Abdullah laughed over his shoulder, pulling the bike into a faster lane of traffic. No fighting today, Lin. I'm taking you for a surprise. A good surprise.
Now I'm worried, I called back. What kind of surprise?
You remember when I took you to see Dr. Hamid? You remember that surprise?
Yeah, I remember.
Well, it is better than that. Much better.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm still not very relaxed about it. Give me another hint.
You remember when I sent you the bear for hugging?
Kana, sure, I remember.
Well, it is much better than that.
A doctor and a bear, I called out above the growl of the engine. There's a lot of space between them, brother. One more hint.
Ha! He laughed, coming to a stop at a set of traffic lights. I will say to you this. The surprise is so good that you will forgive me for all that you suffered when you thought I was dead.
I do forgive you, Abdullah.
No, Lin brother. I know you do not forgive me. I have too many bruises, and I am too much sore from our boxing and karate.
It wasn't true. I never hit him as hard as he hit me. Although he was healing well, and he was very fit, he'd never fully recovered the uncanny strength and charismatic vitality he'd known before the police shooting. And when he removed his shirt to box with me, the sight of his scarred body, it was as if he'd been savaged by the claws of wild animals and burned with hot iron brands. Always made me pull my punches. Still, I never admitted that to him.
Okay, I laughed. If that's the way you're going to play it, I don't forgive you. But when you see this surprise, he called out, laughing with me, you will forgive me completely, with a full heart. Now, come on, stop asking me about it, and tell me, what did Salman say to Sanjay about that pig, that chuha? How did you know that's what we were talking about? I can see the look on Salman's face, he shouted back. And Sanjay, he told me this morning that he wants to ask Salman again to make business with Chuha. So, what did Salman say?
You know the answer to that one, I replied a little more quietly as we stopped in traffic.
Good. Nushkur Allah.
Thanks be to God. You really hate Chuha, don't you?
I don't hate him,
he clarified, moving off with the flow of cars.
I just want to kill him.
We were silent for a while, breathing the warm wind and watching the black business unfold on the streets we'd both roamed so often. There were 100 large and small scams and deals going down around us every minute, and we knew them all. When we found ourselves twisted into a knot of traffic behind a stalled bus, I looked along the footpath and noticed Taj Raj, a pickpocket who usually worked the gateway area near the Taj Mahal Hotel. He'd survived a machete attack years before that had all but severed his neck. The wound caused him to speak in a rattling whisper, and his head was set at such an ill-balanced angle that when he wagged it to agree with someone, he almost fell over. He was working the stumble-fall-pilfer game with his friend Indra, serving as the stumbler. Indra, known as the poet, spoke almost all of his sentences in rhyming couplets. They were deeply moving in their beauty for the first few stanzas, but always found their way into sexual descriptions and allusions so perverse and abhorrent that strong, wicked men winced to hear them. Legend had it that Indra had once recited his poetry through a microphone during a street festival and had cleared the entire Kalaba market of shoppers and traders alike. Even the police, it was said, had shrunk back in horror until exhaustion overcame the poet, and then they'd rushed him as he paused for breath. I knew both men and liked them, though I never let them get closer than an arm's stretch from my pocket. And sure enough, as the bus finally grumbled to life and the traffic began to ease forward, I watched Indra pretending to be blind, not his best performance, but good enough, and stumbling into a foreigner. And Taj Raj, the helpful passerby, assisted both of them to their feet and relieved the foreigner of his burdensome wallet.
Why?
I asked, when we were moving through free space again.
Why what? Why do you want to kill Chuha? I know he had a meeting with the men from Iran,
Abdullah shouted over his shoulder.
People say it was just business. Sanjay, he says it was just business. But I think more than business. I think he worked with them, against Kader Khan, against us. For that reason, Lin.
Okay, I called back, pleased to have my own instincts about Chuha confirmed, but worried for my wild Iranian friend. But don't do anything without me, okay? He laughed and turned his head to show me the white teeth of his smile.
I'm serious, Abdullah. Promise me. Tik ay, Lin brother, he shouted in reply. I will call you when the time is right.
He coasted the bike to a stop and parked it outside the Strand Coffee House, one of my favourite breakfast dives near the Kalaba Market.
What the hell's going on? I demanded as we walked toward the market. Some surprise, I come here nearly every day. I know, he answered, grinning enigmatically. And I am not the only one who knows it.
What's that supposed to mean?
You will find out, Lin brother. Here are your friends.
We came upon Vikram Patel and the Zodiac Georges, Scorpio and Gemini, sitting comfortably on bulging sacks of lentils beside a pulses stall and drinking chai from glasses.
Hey, man, Vikram greeted me. Pull up a sack and make yourself at home.
Abdullah and I shook hands all round, and as we sat down on the row of sacks, Scorpio George signalled a chai runner to bring two more glasses. The passport work was often keeping me busy at night, because Krishna and Vilu, both of them with young children in their growing families, had taken to staggering their shifts, giving themselves valuable hours at home during the day. That work with the books and other commitments to the Salman Council prevented me from going to Leopold's as often as I once had. Whenever I could, I'd meet with Vikram and the Georges near Vikram's apartment on the edge of the Kolaba market. Vikram was there most days after his lunch with Letty. He kept me up to date with the news from Leopold's. Didier had fallen in love again, and Ranjit, Carla's new boyfriend, was becoming popular. And the Georges filled me in on what was going down on the streets.
We thought you weren't coming today, man, Vikram said as the chai arrived.
Abdullah gave me a lift, I replied, frowning at my friend's mysterious smile. And we got stuck in traffic. It was worth it, though.
I had a front row seat for Taj Raj and Indra doing their stumble routine on MG Road. It was quite a show.
He's not what he used to be, our Taj Raj, Gemini commented, hurling Liverpool at us in the vowels of the last two words. Not as nimble-like. Since the accident, you know, his timing's a bit off. I mean, it's only reasonable, innit? His old bleeding head was damn near off and all, so it's no wonder his timing's got a kink in it.
At this point, Scorpio George interrupted, lowering his head and assuming the solemn piety we all knew well and dreaded more. I think we should all bow our heads in prayer. We glanced at one another, our eyes widening in alarm. There was no escape. We were too comfortable to move, and Scorpio knew it. We were trapped. Oh, Lord, Scorpio began.
Oh, God, Gemini grumbled.
And Lady, Scorpio continued, infinite yin-yang spirit in the sky, we humbly ask you to hear the prayers today of five souls that you put into the world and left in the temporary care of Scorpio, Gemini, Abdullah, Vikram, and Lin.
What does he mean, temporary?
Vikram whispered to me, and I shrugged in reply. Please help us, Lord, Scorpio intoned, his eyes shut and his face raised to heaven, which seemed, roughly, to be in the middle of the balcony on the third floor of the Vijay Premnath Academy of Hair Colouring and Ear Boring. Please guide us to know what's right, and to do the right thing. And you can start, God, if you're of a mind, by helping out with the little business deal we're doing with the Belgian couple tonight. I don't have to tell you, Lord and Lady, how tricky it is to supply customers with good quality cocaine in Bombay. But thanks to your providence, we managed to find 10 grams of A-grade snow. And given the real bad drought on the streets, that was a mighty slick piece of work on your part, God, if you'll accept my professional admiration. Anyway, Gemini and me, we sure could use the commission on that deal, and it would be kind of nice not to get ripped off or beaten up or maimed or killed. Unless, of course, that's in your plan. So please light the way and fill our hearts with love. Signing off now, but keeping the line open, as always, I'll say amen.
Amen, Gemini responded, clearly relieved that the prayer was far shorter than Scorpio's more usual efforts.
Amen,
Vikram sobbed, nudging a tear from his eye with the knuckles of a bald fist.
Astaghfirullah, Abdullah muttered.
Forgive me, Allah.
So, how about a bite to eat then? Gemini suggested cheerily. There's nothing like a bit of religion to put you in the frame of mind to make a pig of yourself, is there?
At that moment, Abdullah leaned forward to whisper into my left ear.
Look slowly. No, slowly. Look over there, behind the peanut shop near the corner. Do you see him? You're surprised, Brother Lin. Do you see him?
And then, still smiling, my eyes were drawn to a stooped figure watching us from the shadows beneath an awning.
He is here every day, Abdullah whispered. And not only here, in some other places that you go also. He watches you. He waits and he watches you.
Vikram, I mumbled, wanting some other testament to what I was seeing.
Look, there on the corner.
Look at what, man?
With my attention upon him, the figure drew back into the shadows and then turned and loped away, limping, as if the whole left side of his body was damaged.
Didn't you see him?
No, man, see who?
Vikram complained, standing with me to squint in the direction of my frantic stare.
It's Medina!
I shouted, running after the limping Spaniard. I didn't look back at Vikram, Abdullah, and the Zodiacs. I didn't answer Vikram's call. I didn't think about what I was doing or why I was pursuing him. My mind was only one thought, one image, and one word. Modena. He was fast, and he knew the streets well. It occurred to me, as he ducked into hidden doorways and all but invisible gaps between buildings, that I was probably the only foreigner in the city who knew those streets as well as he did. For that matter, there were few Indians, only touts and thieves and junkies, who could have kept up with him. He scrambled into a hole that someone had knocked through a high stone wall to create an access hatch from one street to another. He stepped around a partition that seemed as solid as brick, but was made from stretched and painted canvas. He took shortcuts through improvised shops in sheltering archways and weaved his way along the labyrinth lines of washed, brightly coloured saris hung out to dry. And then he made a mistake. He ran into a narrow lane that had been commandeered by homeless pavement dwellers and extended families that were crowded out of local apartments. I knew it well. About 100 men, women and children were living in the converted lane. They slept in shifts, in a loft space they'd built above the cobbled lane and between the walls of adjacent buildings. They did everything else in the long, dark, narrow room that the lane had become.
Modena dodged between the seated and standing groups, between cooking stoves and bathing stalls and a blanket of card players. Then, at the end of the lane room, he turned left instead of right. It was a cul-de-sac surrounded by high, sheer walls. It was completely dark, and it ended in a little dogleg where the space curved around the blind corner of another building. We'd used it sometimes to make buys with drug dealers we didn't completely trust, because there was only one way in or out. I rounded the corner, only a few steps behind him, and stood there, panting and straining my eyes to pierce the darkness. I couldn't see him, but I knew he had to be in there. Modena, I said softly into the black echoes. It's Lynn. I just want to talk to you. I'm not trying to... I know you're in here. I'll just put my bag down and light us up a beady, okay? One for you, one for me. I put the bag down slowly, expecting him to make a rush past me. I took a bundle of beadies from my shirt pocket and extracted two from the pack. Holding them between my third and fourth fingers, thick ends inwards, as every poor man in the city did, I worked open a box of matches and struck one. With the flame playing over the ends of the cigarettes, I allowed myself a glimpse upward, and I saw him, cringing away from the little arc of light thrown by the match. Just as the match died, I extended my arm to offer him one of the glowing beady cigarettes. In the new dark, after the match failed, I waited for a second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds. And then I felt his fingers, softer and more delicate in their grasp than I would have believed, close around my own and accept the cigarette. When he puffed at the beady, I saw his face clearly for the first time. It was grotesque. Maurizio had sliced and slashed so much suffering into the soft skin that it was almost frightening simply to look at it. In the faint orange light, I saw the sneering smile that gleamed in Modena's eyes as he recognized the horror in my own. How many times, I wondered, had he seen that horror in the eyes of others? That wide white dread as they imagined his scars on their own faces and his torment in their souls. How many times had he seen others flinch as I'd flinched, and shrink away from his wounds, as if from the open sores of a disease? How many times had he seen men ask themselves, what did he do? What did he do to deserve this? Maurizio's knife had opened both cheeks beneath the dark brown eyes. The cuts had healed into long, Y-shaped scars that dragged down the lower lids of his eyes and ran like the trails of hideous, mocking tears. The lower lids, permanently red and raw, gaped open in little trenches of agony that revealed the whole globe of each eye. The wings and septum of his nose had been cut through to the bone. The skin, when it closed together, had fused in jagged whorls at the sides, but not at all in the centre, where the laceration was too deep. The wide hole where his nostrils had been resembled the snout of a pig and flared with every inward breath. There were many more cuts beside the eyes, around the jaw, and along the full width of his brow below the hairline. It looked as though Maurizio had tried to peel off the whole layer of Modena's face, and the 100 scars that encircled his features were puckered here and there into little mounds of flesh that might have matched the outstretched fingers of a man's hands. I knew that there had to be other scars and injuries beneath his clothes. The movements of his arm and leg on the left side of his body were awkward, as if the hinges at elbow, shoulder, and knee had stiffened around wounds that had never really healed. It was a monstrous mutilation, a disfigurement so calculated in its cruelty that I felt numbed by it and unable to respond. I noticed that there were no marks on or near his mouth. I wondered at the fortune that had left his sensuous and finely sculpted lips so perfect, so flawlessly unscarred,
Then I remembered that Maurizio had gagged him when